From these television appearances, I got a welcome job in 1971 with Ann Margaret, 5 weeks opening the show for her at the International Hilton in Vegas, a huge, unfunny barn with sculptured pink cherubs hanging from the corners of the proscenium. Laughter in these poorly designed places rose a few feet into the air and dissipated like steam, always giving me the feeling that I was bombing. One night, from my dressing room, I saw a vision in white gliding down the hall. A tall, striking woman, moving like an apparition along the backstage corridor. It turned out to be Priscilla Presley, coming to visit Ann Margaret backstage after having seen the show. When she turned the corner, she revealed an even more indelible presence walking behind her, Elvis, dressed in white, jet black hair, a diamond-studded buckle. When Priscilla revealed Elvis to me, I was also revealed to Elvis. I'm sure he noticed that this 25-year-old stick figure was frozen firmly to the ground. About to pass me by, Elvis stopped, looked at me, and said in his beautiful Mississippi drawl, "Son, you have an oblique sense of humor." Later, after his visit with Ann Margaret, he stopped by my dressing room and told Bill and me that he too had an oblique sense of humor, which he did, but that his audience didn't get it. Then he said,
"Do you want to see my guns?"
After emptying the bullets into his palm, he showed us two pistols and a derringer. Ann Margaret and her husband Roger Smith were, and still are, a fun and generous couple, and they provided me with work when others wouldn't. The next year they asked if I would open for Ann Margaret at the Fountain Blue Hotel in Miami Beach. I arrived at the hotel, which at the time was very old world, with an even older clientele. I still had my helmet hair, long black frock coat, and turquoise jewelry, and I'd added a really unattractive beard. Opening night, I peeked at the audience, older Jewish couples. I smelled disaster. Jerry Lewis once described standing backstage before a show and listening to the tone of the audience, concluding, "I knew I was dead." I could hear the echoing rattle of forks on plates and the low, enervated dinner chit-chat. I went on, and killed, night after night. I was going over like it was a raucous college campus. Why, I wondered. I was baffled until Roger Smith explained it to me. They look at you in your hippie clothes and beard and they think, "Aw, it's my son." The Plum television appearance during the 60s and 70s was The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. Bob Shane, who in the late 60s booked The Steve Allen Show, had moved over to The Tonight Show and mentioned me to its producer, Freddie DeCorvita. Bob showed Freddie a kinescope, an expensive 16mm film financed by my bank account, of my appearance on The Steve Allen Show, and Fred replied, "I don't think he's for us." But Bob persisted, and Johnny saw the film and said, "Let's give him a try." To close the deal, I went to NBC one afternoon and auditioned on the soundstage, in front of staff and crew, while cables were being pulled and cameras were being moved. I was booked on the show in October 1972. There was a belief that one appearance on The Tonight Show made you a star. But here are the facts. The first time you do the show, nothing. The second time you do the show, nothing. The sixth time you do the show, someone might come up to you and say, "Hi, I think we met at Harry's Christmas party." The tenth time you do the show, you could conceivably be remembered as being seen somewhere on television. The 12th time you do the show, you might hear, "Oh, I know you. You're that guy." But I didn't know that. Before the show, as I stood in the backstage darkness behind the curtains of The Tonight Show, hearing the muffled laughter while Johnny spoke and waiting for the tap on the shoulder that would tell me I was on, an italicized sentence ticker-taped through my head. "I am about to do The Tonight Show." Then I walked out on stage, started my act, and thought, "I am doing The Tonight Show." I finished my act and thought, "I have just done The Tonight Show." What happened while I was out there was very similar to an alien abduction. I remember very little of it, though I'm convinced it occurred. I was booked back and did the show successfully several times. I was doing material from my act, Best Stuff First, and after two or three appearances, I realized how little best stuff I had. After I'd gone through my stage material, I started doing some nice but oddball bits such as Comedy Act for Dogs, first done on Steve Allen, in which I said, "A lot of dogs watch TV and there's nothing really on for them, so call your dog over and let him watch because I think you're going to see him crack up for the first time." Then I brought out four dogs that I can perform to so I can get the timing down. While I did terrible canine-related jokes, the dogs would walk off one at a time, with the last dog lifting his leg on me. The studio audience saw several trainers out of camera range, making drastic hand signals, but the home TV audience saw only the dogs doing their canine best. Another time, I claimed that I could read from the phone book and make it funny. I opened the book and droned the names to predictable silence. Then I pretended to grow more and more desperate and began to do retro shtick, such as cracking eggs on my head. I got word that Johnny was not thrilled, and I was demoted to appearing with guest hosts, which I tried not to admit to myself was a devastating blow. I was growing frustrated with writing for television. Although the income was financing my performing career, I was marking time, and the prize of performing regularly on one of the shows was not materializing. I realized that the performers were just using my material as a starting point, and of course, I thought the better joke was to do it as written. On the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, I was thrown the occasional performing bone, appearing as a walk-on with a line or two in a sketch, but I felt no resonance from the producers or audience. There was a baffling moment when Sonny Bono and his partner Dennis Pregnolato, who were becoming showbiz entrepreneurs, approached me at work and took me aside. Sonny and Dennis had seen me perform, I don't know where, and Sonny said, "Steve, we've been watching you. We think you are the next big thing, bigger than David Brenner, bigger than Albert Brooks. We would like to work with you and develop a show for you." I nodded my excitement and never heard from them again, not one word. In the early 70s, I had two memorable auditions. One was for Greg Garrison, the producer of the Dean Martin Show. The audition went like this. I did my act for his secretary, then she did it for Greg. She even borrowed a prop from me to take into his office. My other audition began with a call from a producer who told me about a sitcom pilot called The Fireman's Ball. "They specifically asked for you," he said. I heard this sentence as, "They specifically asked only for you." I practiced the scene, went to the audition, and was surprised to see at least a dozen other young guys marching around a foyer, holding scripts and inaudibly mouthing their lines. I didn't get hired, but the experience was significant for me. I understood I would never be hired in that situation, that the odds of confluence on a certain day of the producer's desires, my talent, and a good reading were low, and that the audition process was a dead end. I decided to leave Hollywood and go on the road. I resigned from television writing against the advice of my agent, a man who had wisely vacuumed up all the young talent discovered by the Smothers Brothers. He said plainly, "Stick to writing," which was a polite way of saying that my performing was headed nowhere. I took this warning with a strange delight. It was, in a way, the necessary ingredient in any young career, like when Al Jolson was told in The Jazz Singer, "Jolie, you'll never become a singer." Bill McEwen had moved to Aspen, Colorado for the skiing, and I moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico to escape the Los Angeles smog and traffic. I was 28 years old when a bleak thought occurred to me. What if nothing happens? I had never really imagined success. I was just trying to be a performer, but I could not see myself playing dreary nightclubs into my 30s, 40s, and 50s. I would have struggled composing a real-world resume, as my abilities were at best vague and at worst unusable. I decided to give it until I was 30, and then I would have to figure out something else to do. The Road. My departure from television writing meant that I was now adrift. I had lost my financial support and my hyphen, and now was only a comedian. A club owner in Denver, Chet Hansen, started up a small agency, and even though comedy clubs did not exist yet, he somehow produced wide-ranging bookings that involved planes, trains, and automobiles. For the next few years, I was on the road with an itinerary designed by the Marquis de Sade. There was a sexy anonymity about the travel. I was living the folky myth of having no ties to anyone, working small clubs and colleges in improvised folk rooms that were usually subterranean. However, the travel isolated me. Friends were available only through costly phone calls, and contact with my parents and sister spiraled down to a pinpoint. In this netherworld, I was free to experiment. These out-of-the-way and varied places provided a tough comedy education. There were no mentors to tell me what to do. There were no guidebooks for doing stand-up. Everything was learned in practice, and the lonely road, with no critical eyes watching, was the place to dig up my boldest or dumbest ideas and put them on stage. At night, preoccupied by the success or failure of that evening's show, I would return to my motel room and glumly watch the three TV channels sign off the air at 11:30, knowing that I had at least 2 more hours of ceiling staring to do before the adrenaline eased off and I could fall asleep. While I toured around the country, Bill had found a Los Angeles agent whom we both adored, Marty Klein. Marty, who loved gold cigarette lighters, fancy eyeglasses, and quality suits, made sure I saw the old-time world of show business before it was gone, taking me to the Brown Derby restaurant in Hollywood, where the walls were lined with celebrity caricatures from the 30s and 40s, and the Sands Hotel in Vegas, where the Rat Pack had cavorted. Bill was also promoting my name to record companies. A recording contract was our quest, though I secretly worried about a record's potential as my act was becoming more and more visual. "And now," I would announce, "my impression of the Incredible Shrinking Man." I would ask the audience to close their eyes for a moment, and when they reopened them, I had raised the microphone several feet. Another bit, I would wonder what it would be like if the human body had only one arm right in the center of our chest. How would we applaud? Putting my elbow in the center of my torso, I would then slap myself in the face a dozen times. I took on an excellent roadie, Maple Byrne, whom I met at a defunct recording studio where he lived in the echo chamber. He was a real deadhead who had to vanish now and then to see a Grateful Dead concert. He booked my travel, set up the props, checked the sound, and ran the lights. Despite his presence, on the road I was fundamentally a loner, withdrawn and solitary, and his introduction of mournful Irish folk music into my life didn't help my mood. We would drive at night from job to job, listening to cassette tapes of the Bothy Band, sad, lonely songs for the sad, lonely road. One of the tunes, The Maid of Cool Moor, inspired a film I wrote 12 years later, L.A. Story. When necessary, I could still manage to have a personality, and sometimes I was rescued by a local girl who actually liked me. Occasionally the result was an erotic tryst enhanced by loneliness. Perhaps the women saw it as I did, an encounter free from obligation. The next day, I would be gone. I had also refined my pickup technique. If I knew I would be returning to a club, I tweaked my hard-learned rule, never hit on a waitress the first night, to never hit on a waitress for 6 months. I came off as coolly reserved, as I would harmlessly flirt on my first visit. By my next visit, everything was in place. Soon the 6 months caught up with me, and I always had someone I could latch onto as I rolled from town to town. I did have interludes of monogamy with a few women. Iris was an aspiring actress who, coincidentally, lived next door, which cut down on travel time for sudden sleepover urges. Chris Gooch, a fragile, ethereal blonde, seemed to float into the club I was playing, the Vanguard in Kansas City, Missouri. We lived together in Los Angeles for a while. Sandy Oliver, her last name described the color of her skin, lived in Atlanta, and we rendezvoused in towns across America. Were they beautiful? We were all beautiful. We were in our 20s. I alternated obscure appearances across America with higher-profile opening act jobs at the Boarding House in San Francisco, the Troubadour in Los Angeles, and the Great Southeast Music Hall in Atlanta, where I first performed with the singer-comedian Martin Mull. Martin's wit was Sahara dry. He performed on stage sitting on living room furniture and sang his own comic songs, with titles like Noses Run in My Family, I'm Everyone I Ever Loved, How Could I Not Miss a Girl Your Size, and Jesus Christ Football Star. On opening night at the Great Southeast Music Hall, we were both nervous about meeting each other. I was sitting in my open dressing room when Martin walked by, carrying his stage clothes on a hanger. Unsure whether to say something to me, he kept going. After a few steps, I called out, "Nice meeting you, too!" We've been friends ever since. Martin suggested me to his recording label, Capricorn Records. The response from the producer, Phil Walden, was, "Too visual, he's too visual." Later, after my first record shipped platinum, meaning it had already sold 1 million before it was released, Phil called up Martin, "Hey, Mull, you know any more of those visual guys?" In Los Angeles, the Troubadour was my hangout, and the girls did indeed get prettier as closing time neared, or maybe it was I who got prettier to them. The troubadour's regulars included Michael Nesmith, Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchell, Glenn Frey, Don Henley, and all the others whose music was a siren call to a perceptive record executive named David Geffen. One week I opened the show for Linda Ronstadt. She sang barefoot on a raised stage and wore a silver lamé dress that stopped a millimeter below her panties, causing the floor of the troubadour to be slick with drool. Linda and I saw each other for a while, but I was so intimidated by her talent and street smarts that, after the ninth date, she finally said, "Steve, do you often date girls and not try to sleep with them?" We parted chaste. One night I was lingering in the bar and talking to Glenn Frey, who was just leaving his duo Long Branch Penny Whistle. He said he was considering a name for his new five-man group. "What is it?" I said. He said, "Eagles." I said, "Oh, you mean the Eagles?" He said, "No, Eagles." I said, "You mean the Eagles?" He said, "No, I mean Eagles." The name of the group remains, of course, Eagles.